So what you do is you prepare it originally in this state. And so that's the state that you have after the first beam splitters, except that you have a phase factor of I, which doesn't do anything. And then at the end, you're post-selecting the state. If you look at what's effectively happening, the arrangement of beam splitters and phase shifter, what they're doing is they're post-selecting in that state. Does that ring true? Can you see that would be the case? So this is the path that has the phase shifter in. So the generalization of this three box paradox due to Weidman, I think it's a Harrenhoven-Weidman, is that this state instead here you have your initial state that you want to pre-select in, you want to prepare your system in is this. And this this zero term here, he's quite weighty. It has a big amplitude in front of it compared with the other terms. And it's going to need that because it's got to cancel most of this. Just like here in the interferometer, you had to use the A0 to cancel either the A1 or the A2. Here, this has got to cancel most of the rest. And now you post-select in this state. So if you want to draw this as an interferometer, here's the best way I could think of doing it. You have your preparation. It comes in. Then your internal paths are like this. So the geometry is slightly different. The particles go in this way, come back out that way. The reason I needed that is because I wanted to put extra weight on this particular path. A phase shifter here. And now you want this this beam splitter to reflect most of the amplitude up here because you want to get that kind of weighting. So you want R to be equal to, for this one to be equal to one, to be equal, sorry, N minus one over 2n-1, just the the square of the coefficient in front. And then each of these subsequent beam splitters has got to pick off sort of 1/n of the sort of amplitude squared. So they're all equal, they all have equal amplitudes. And so the way to do that, I think, is to choose them to have, this one to have reflectivity 1 over and this one to have reflectivity 1 over minus 1, etc., all the way down to this one, which has reflectivity equals 1 over 1. I think that works. And so now, if I block any one of these paths, take this one for example, then the total amplitude that's flowing through all the other paths meets back here should be equal to the amplitude that came along this path, except that there is a phase shift in this one, so they interfere destructively. Okay. Does that work? Does that make sense to everyone? Any questions? Yeah. So the tricky thing I didn't appreciate was that you have to sort of change the geometry to have it going back. Yes, go.
So in tutorial yesterday, I tried working it out with the geometry more like where the detector is on the other end. And I don't know, I might have done some calculations wrong, but it seemed to work out if all of the interior reflectors were 1/2 and the one by the detector was 1/3 and the one at this. And you only needed to alter the reflectivity of the one at the source.
Oh, okay. So that could be the case. Have to check the details. I just plumbed for this because it seemed that you had to treat this first one on a different footing, and I could see how to do it. But yeah, it may well work as well. Any other questions? Did you have any thoughts on what the significance of this result is? One thing that people might try and say, well, this means that the particle is wherever you look for it, and so therefore it's in all those places at once, which presumably isn't right. There's been some debate in the literature as to what this means. I don't have a fixed opinion. I think as long as you can build classical models that do the same thing. As long as you allow the measurement to disturb the system. Because if the measurement disturbs the system, then the fact that you get detection here will depend on how you disturb the system. And so it's not really a contradiction. On the other hand, if the measurement doesn't disturb the system, if the measurement is just passively looking to see where the particle is, then you can't really account for this result. Not in a classical way. And then the second question, Aggie said there was some issue as to whether the bomb is performing a measurement, whether this is really like the quantum Zeno effect. So I would say it is, in the sense that what the bomb is doing is it's the trigger of the bomb is at each time step, there are two. You could think of the bomb as performing a measurement which has one of two outcomes. Either the bomb does explode or it doesn't explode at each time step. And the case where it doesn't explode is a measurement which is associated with a projection operator onto the upper path. So I think you can think of it as being strictly analogous to the quantum Zeno effect. I should say, proposal for increasing the rate, the success rate for the Elitzer-Weidman bomb problem. This was in a paper. It was in an experimental paper in Anton Zeilinger's group, in Austria, when he was in Innsbruck, the guy who had the idea how to do this, who was part of that collaboration, was Mark Kasevich. Do you know how to spell Mark Kasevich? I think it begins with a C. So that's the paper where they had that idea. Can you hear me, Kay? Yeah, I take your word. Okay, well then he may not be the first author who begins with Kay.
Yes.
It doesn't what, sorry?
Will you not end up having to do infinite tests, but using infinite resources on every bomb that has no trigger? You'll never get a conclusive result.
Well, I suppose I'm assuming that you have a factory in there outputting bombs. 50% of them are good, 50% are bad. Perhaps if you have a bomb which has no trigger and you test it a few times, then you just conclude, well, this is never going to give me the D result. It's probably a bad bomb. Let's move on to the next one. So that would be the approach there. I mean, in fact, you put very good constraint on it being a bad bomb. If, since the probability is arbitrarily close to one for this test, if that detector never fires, then it's, okay. So let me move on to the actual lecture. So I want to carry on, return rather, to talking about interferometry. So I'm going to talk about quantum optical interferometry this time. And I'm going to take the simplest possible strategy here. So I'm going to do single mode. Single mode case. So I'm assuming that my photons they're in modes, and I'm just taking the case where these modes you assume you have a sort of a fixed momentum in each mode. Fixed k vector, let's say. A more realistic choice, a more realistic treatment would be to do multimode so that you can get sort of actual wave packets which have some thickness. If you want to analyze real experiments in detail, you need to do that. But you can get a lot of insight with the single mode case. And often a pretty good quantitative agreement with the experiments. So the trick is to use annihilation and creation operators. So we have creation operators. And annihilation. Which have, say, with, and on which one? This one? No. Sorry? Oh, you guys use, sorry. That's right, that is the convention I want to use. So you have this property for annihilation operators. And this property for creation operators. And you have the commutation relations, which actually follow from these equations. Okay. This means that we have n photons. In mode A. And the mode is given, is specified here by some wave vector. And also some polarization. We're going to take the polarizations to all be fixed, so they could all be vertically polarized, let's say. There's a lot of interest in quantum optics where you also use the polarization degree of freedom, but I won't talk about that today. Okay. So you remember how I set up the rules for interferometers in the previous case? I'm going to go through and do the same thing. So first of all, we have linear optical devices. So a mirror. You have some mode. I'm just going to keep calling it the same mode, otherwise we end up with too many letters knocking around in our diagrams. Doesn't really. I mean, you can change it if you want. And we'll say, so for mirror, the transformation, we'll say it's like this. I'll write down the transformations for the creation operators. Because those are going to play a bigger role in what we do. But we could instead take the complex or take the Hermitian conjugate of this and get the roles, the annihilation operators. We have some path length like this. We have a phase shifter. Then we pick up a phase shift. And if we have a beam splitter, then we have a sort of beam splitter type transformation on the modes. So like that.
Is there not some inconsistency in regarding the beam splitter as changing the mode on?
I don't think so. I mean,
What was the question?
is there not some inconsistency on regarding the beam structure changing the mode, like mode label, and not the mirror? I mean, you sort of need to here. But it just makes life much simpler if you introduce new modes here, because you have
Right,
two
I saw
coming
it
out.
being clear, but I feel as though there's some inconsistency in the description if you don't also
I mean,
have the mirror.
any calculation, I can't see how it would be a problem. I mean, you certainly could if you wanted here. It probably would be the more natural to do that. It's just then every time you have a mirror in this arrangement, you'd have another letter, and it would make the calculations more complicated.
I understand why it's simpler, it's just not
Yeah.
consistent. Yeah. But I don't think it causes any problems in practice.
Okay, it's always send me a little things.
Well, it's either the same mode or a different mode, I guess.
I mean, the calculations would never care because there's no mixing here. I mean, I think you're right. If you want to do things calculation in a proper way, you wouldn't do this. You'd use a different symbol. But since you get the same answer anyway, and I'm a pragmatic kind of guy when it comes to these calculations, I'm going to stick with the simpler approach for calculations. Okay. So, So those are all the linear optical elements I want. And they're linear just because they're you have linear relationships on the mode operators. So these all induce a unitary transformation on the state. So, for example, imagine I had a state like this. So I have a state like this impinging on a beam splitter. So these are the input modes. Then what I could do is, well, I can write this state down like this. Is right. So just rather than writing the Fock states here, bring out the creation operators. And now apply the transformations here. what does that go to? That goes to script T. So we've transformed the state, and the claim is that this is a unitary transformation under this replacement. Okay. So actually, when I was thinking about this morning, I don't have an immediate proof that this transformation is unitary. I'd like maybe someone could come up with a proof. That would be nice. If it isn't, then the whole approach is wrong, of course. So obviously it's unitary. I didn't immediately see the reason. So there's a homework exercise, or a supplementary exercise, let's call it that, prove that these transformations are unitary in general. I think it must be trivial, but I don't immediately see the reason. Does anyone see the reason why this transformation must be, or these sorts of transformations in general have to be unitary?
Actually, quick question. I'm a little confused about what Hilbert space these things are living in, because it seems like when we say it's going into a new mode, we're just defining a new space for it to live in.
Yeah, right. Good. So I'm being a bit sloppy here with this notation. What I could do here is really, I should just write this down as zero. It's probably the best thing to do. Okay. And likewise here. But I'm writing it. now, over here, really, I should also be adding in that I have zero in all other modes. All other modes. Okay. And so is that clearer now? That makes sense. Yeah. So that's the non-stoppy way of doing things. Yeah. Okay. And of course, the one thing that's clear about quantum optics is it's much easier to do these calculations using those mode operators than it is to try and find these unitary operators just a priori. You could imagine writing down these big unitary transformations that act on a big state with many different modes in them on here, but they'd be very complicated objects, whereas they're very simply expressed in this creation, in this annihilation operator language. Okay. Then I need a few more things. We need detectors. So I'm going to assume we have detectors like this. And that these detectors measure the photon number. Okay. Actually, the detectors that people have in practice struggle to measure just one photon. Actually, do it with quite low efficiency. We'll just consider the case where you have detectors that can actually measure how many photons you have. And then I want some sources. Lasers, the ones that I saw, always seem to be in long boxes, so I'll draw them like that. And we're going to take the state that's produced by a laser to be a coherent state. This is a gross oversimplification. Real lasers produce more complicated states, but this works well for sort of basic analysis of experiments. These coherent states are just defined to be eigenstates of the annihilation operator. Of the annihilation operator. And you can write in terms of the Fock basis. You can expand a coherent state down like this. So you can see what you have is a linear superposition of lots of different number states starting with n equals zero. In fact, the biggest term is the vacuum term. And, well, actually, that's not true. for small alpha, the biggest term is the vacuum term. How many people are familiar with coherent states, this kind of quantum optics? Yeah, fair number of you. Yeah, and you too. One of the nice properties about coherent states is what they do at a beam splitter. See, if I have a beam splitter like this. And I send a coherent state in to both inputs. Who knows what the output is in this case? So what's interesting is that the output is a product state. So the input here is a product state, and the output is also a product state. It looks like this. So this is also, these are coherent states as well. So you send coherent states in, and then you get coherent states out, so product state. And it shows you that, that these coherent states sort of capture a certain classicality. They have a certain, classical property. They don't get entangled when you send them through a beam splitter. And then the final thing I want to introduce in terms of things that you can use to do experiments is parametric down conversion. It's used in a lot of these interesting quantum optical experiments. Okay. So this is literally a little crystal that you can buy in the right shops. So in these quantum optical experiments, what they do is they pump them with a laser. I want to put the laser in here. And defining the object. So you have some input mode here, which you usually shine a laser into. And then usually they have no further use for the laser, so they absorb it with a little some sort of, what do they call these, neutral density filters? Blockers, okay, a blocker, yeah. These are blocker, yeah. Yeah. Okay. And then you have sort of what happens in roughly speaking is you can think of photons in this laser beam and they get down converted, i.e. split into pairs of photons coming out whose momenta sum to the momenta of the photon here originally. So you have one photon here and one photon here. In the literature, it's usual to talk about one of these being the signal photon, one of them being the idler photon. I don't really understand why, and I think it's arbitrary as to which is which. Is it arbitrary? Okay, but is it arbitrary? Is there any reason to choose? Okay, right. Okay, so one of them is called the signal. One of the it makes no difference for our purposes. I'm just going to call them A and B, or whatever particular idler. Yeah. Okay. So what's actually happening is these photons get spat out in a range of directions. You get a pair of photons, and they could go out in any directions as long as the the sum of the wave vectors adds to the original, to the wave vector associated with the original laser. But then you can pick out using pinholes some preferred directions. Okay. And as long as you place these pinholes so that they collect pairs of photons that satisfy this matching condition, then you'll get this nice source of pairs of photons coming out at the same time. Okay. And you can think of the, what's happening here is that you have some sort of quite short time evolution. The lasers, obviously this happens very quickly. So you can treat it in an interaction Hamiltonian picture. And you can write down the interaction Hamiltonian for this situation. So it's a sum of this term plus the Hermitian conjugate, which is just, I guess, A, B, and S dagger. So this is the particular term we're always going to be interested in. And you can see what this is doing is it's annihilating a photon in the laser and then creating a photon in each of these output modes. If I hadn't picked out with pinholes placed appropriately, then you'd have a sum over all these modes, and you'd be always making sure that the matching condition was satisfied. Any questions? So the unitary transformation that's being affected here is this one. We're always going to be in the regime where this leads to a pretty low rate of down conversion of photons into these beams. So we only need to use the first order term here. And so that's this term isn't going to do anything for us because we don't really have any photons in the AB modes to annihilate. So this term does nothing for us. Oh yeah, delta T as well. Yeah. Right. So the reason I went to all this trouble of setting up this basic framework is so that I can go through some interesting experiments to hopefully teach us something interesting about quantum theory, as usual. There's a big literature of these experiments that have been done, and this what I've outlined here is sufficient to understand many of those experiments. I don't have long left, but let me go through some of them. So this is kind of a calibration experiment, if you like. So we just pump one of these crystals and place detectors in the two outputs. What we get is, well, we should apply. We start off with some initial state having a coherent state in the laser input. And then we have the vacuum in modes A and B. Now we want to apply this unitary transformation. So what do we get? Well, we get the identity just gives us the same thing. But then we get the interesting term coming from here. We have the annihilation operator acting on the laser, brings out an alpha. And then we have the creation operators acting on the A and B modes, which puts a photon in both of those. And of course, if we were to expand the higher terms, then we'd also get terms which have more photons, like two photons in each mode and three photons and so on. But we're going to stick to the limit where the pump is low intensity. So it's very unlikely that we see that. And now, if we look at this experiment, then what we're going to see is a very big probability for seeing no photons, and then a small probability for seeing one photon in each detector. But when we do see a photon here, when we do see one photon here, then we also will see a photon here. Okay. Any questions? Okay. So next I want to do what's called the U. It's Mandel. Yeah. Both spellings are possible. Oh, how do you pronounce it? U.
You can say von O'Mandel, but I don't know if that's correct. Like,
so
it might
really
be U.
Oh, sorry, U von Mandel, but what do you say?
Von O'Mandel. So, yeah.
Oh, okay. Opal mantle.
I mean, I don't know.
But okay. I used to say, I don't know. Anyway, I'm trying to pronounce it. These three people did an experiment. And the experiment they did was very simple. Took a laser. Oh, jumping the gun here. Pumped a parametric down conversion crystal. They set the phase matching so that this photon and this photon both had equal frequency. And then mix them up as a beam splitter. Actually, incidentally, one thing I didn't explicitly say here when I define the beam splitter is I'm considering here the case where we have equal frequency and equal polarization for the modes going in. Otherwise, it doesn't work. Actually, if they're not equal, that would be okay, wouldn't it? That would still be true. However, no, it wouldn't be true. Yeah, you'd now in the output beams, you'd have more than one frequency. So you'd need more than one mode in the output beams. Yeah. So this is for the case we have the same frequency for the input and output modes. Okay, so here's the experiment they did. And let's place detectors. So we have. Okay. Okay, so let's just go through the calculation quickly. Start off with that, pass through the parametric tan conversion. You have the same thing that we had before. But I'm going to keep the creation operators in play. And I'm just going to use the sloppy notation I was using before for these vacuum things. Okay. Now we want to evolve through the beam splitter here. We can put an I phase shift on each of these, but it doesn't really matter because it's the same in both paths. So let's just forego that formality. And I'm going to take this to be a 50-50 beam splitter. So so what we have here is this interesting term. So let's look at that. Oh, I forgot to include the extra square root of 2 there. Okay, it's too high up, I can't reach. So we have so if we multiply this out, what we get is is that what's that equal to? These are different modes, so they're annihilation operators commute. So there's also another way to see that that has to be zero, at least it has to have no effect in this calculation. I'll come to that in a moment. Okay, so now continue our calculation. And we can see if we now act with this, what we get is okay, I noticed too many mistakes over here, so I have to put them right. One over two, because you have one over square root of two coming in twice. Here we have an alpha, I have delta t. Okay. And now we have this, the creation operator acting twice. So what that's going to give us is a square root of 2 times 2 in mode C and nothing in mode D. The square root of 2 is coming from this, I think I defined right at the very top over there. So you can kind of see that this term had better be zero, even if we didn't know it was zero. Or at least this term had better have no effect on when it was applied to this vacuum state, because here we have conservation of probability, because these square roots of two cancel this to give us one over square root of two. And that's the appropriate normalization factor. So there's no room left for anything else. This had better vanish. And then what you see here is that you have a curious effect that both photons go into the same mode. Either they both go into the C mode or they both go into the D mode. Probabilistic mixture of those, or a quantum superposition of those two things happening. So when you do the experiment, what you see, well, in the ideal experiment where you have number detectors, you'd see two photons in each detector. In the actual experiment, they can't distinguish between one and two photons in the detectors. But what they measure is the coincidence rate between those two detectors, and they see that it's zero when everything is aligned properly. So this is where the experiment is all aligned properly. But if they change the alignment, so they move the beam splitters and so on, they move the mirrors, move one of the mirrors, then it goes back up to the sort of average you'd expect. This is the probability of seeing a coincidence. And so this dip is sometimes called the Wu Hong Mandel dip, or however you pronounce his name. So one of the homework exercises I'm going to set contains a sort of an interesting generalization of this property. Okay. So I still have at least two experiments I'd like to discuss, but I don't want to do that now, so I'll continue with that next time.